Dark Wreath Publishing presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. Autumn semester 2009, this is Business Finance, FIL 240, Section 7. Lecture 9, delivered on September 15, 2009. The title of this lecture is Ratio Analysis.
Today, Ratio Analysis. In this lecture, I will lay out for you the standard ratios that we use in finance, the financial ratios that are normal. Now, there are actually more financial ratios. Some are arcane, obscure, some are old-fashioned, and I would probably use a few ratios myself that I will not show you. I will show you one that is not in the book, that's just one of them that is actually kind of useful, and understand that if you took a more advanced finance class from me, I would probably show you a few more subtle ones. But the ones that I'm showing you here are the standards, and they fall into different categories, although there is a crossing over in what's called the DuPont method, which I will bring up either today or on Thursday. But first, let's work through the ratios. The first set of ratios that I'm going to show you are called the liquidity ratios. The liquidity ratios. And as the name implies, these give in evidence about the liquidity of the corporation. The first is the current ratio. The current ratio is the current assets over the current liabilities. Now, when I give you the formula, that's just the beginning. When I tell you what you're looking at, that's part of why we would care about this. The current ratio tells you how many times over your current assets can pay the current liabilities. How many times over your liquid assets can cover obligations that are in the near future. The current ratio. It is just a very fast ratio. It's one we would all be interested in. However, realistically, current assets are not all of equivalent liquidity. Some of your current assets are more easily liquidated than others. The one that is the least liquid of your liquid assets, of your current assets, is inventory. So the next one we would look at is what is called the quick ratio. This is current assets minus your inventory over your current liabilities. And this one is recognizing that if you were in a pinch, you'd get dimes on the dollars if you were lucky for your inventory. So this says, never mind the inventory. How many times over could we pay our current obligations with stuff that would be at least reasonably liquidatable at value? Well, by the way, the quick ratio is sometimes called the acid test. The acid test. And you'll hear me say acid. That's the way we talk. Okay, acid. Now I'm going to show you one more that is not in the book. And this is the only one I will show you of the arcane. But this one's important enough. This one's called the absolute ratio. The absolute ratio. And this is just your cash and marketable securities over your current liability. This one says if you had to pay all of your current obligations off at the end of the day, writing checks, how many times over could you do that? In other words, I've got checking account cash, I've got money market mutual fund, I've probably got some checks that I could write from there. How many times over, if I had to do it that way, could I do it? By the way, absolute ratio is called the burn test. And you'll hear me call it burn. You might hear me use it as I'm now. What's the burn? Or how good can they burn? Okay, this is, in other words, burn up your cash to get rid of your current liabilities. So you've got your current, your asset, and your burn. And these tell you the ability of the company to cover its liabilities that are in the right now and in the near future with what is on hand that could possibly do that in the current time period or in the near future. Okay. And it's not just these numbers. It's also the relationship of these numbers to each other that matters to us. It's not just these numbers, but it's a relationship of these numbers to each other that we might be interested in. Obviously, we also have to do industry comparatives, look for the comps in the industry, and those you can pull up too in the Standard & Poor's and things like that. The comps are there to have a look at. So all of this is there available. But what is not in the comps and what is probably not in the Standard & Poor's is looking at the ratios in and of themselves and in their relationships to each other in the liquidity. If current and quick are close together, that means that inventory is not a significant part of the current asset picture of the corporation. If you got current and quick that are close and absolute, if your burn is way down there compared to your current and your quick, that is of a little concern. This is a company that is very cash strapped compared to other current assets. So this company had damn well better keep its eye on its bill management, because if the burn is way down there compared to the other ones, well, that kind of concerns me a little bit, because that means that it's got liquid assets, but it sure can't use any of those to write checks. It sure can't use many of those to write checks. Okay, so it's not just each one. It's not each one comped to the industry. It's also these in relationship to each other that matters. Especially this is true with the liquidities. Now let me go to the profitability ratios. The profitability ratios. Profitability, first on deck, is gross margin. What's your gross profit? That is your net of cost of goods sold over your sales. How much do I have after I have paid to make the stuff that I sold? Remember, cost of goods sold is relatively, to some extent, matched stuff, things that I have spent money on that are fairly matched to the stuff that I sold. So I'm asking here, how much did I get to keep after I had paid for what I sold? How much money do I get to keep? So if I had a gross margin of 0.7, that would tell me every dollar in sales, I kept 70 cents of that after I had paid for making what I sold. For every dollar I sold, I get to keep 70 cents after I had paid for what it cost me to make that thing in materials and all of that. Now, I'm just going to walk through these. Operating margin is next on deck. Operating margin, and that's EBIT. Over sales. After I paid all my expenses except for my interest and taxes, how much on every dollar that I sold am I keeping after I've paid all my bills except for my interest and taxes? Okay. Now, along the way, there are a couple I'm not, I don't know if I'm interested in, but I do want to go to net margin. Net is your net income over your sales. And that, again, net income over sales. Now, I do caution you, remember, we're playing with accounting numbers, so we're not really looking at cash flow, which is more important. But through a glass darkly, we peer with accounting numbers. And here, how much at the bottom line did I get to keep for every dollar I sold? And these can be all over the place. Like I said, net margins can be anywhere in some service. I saw a net margin that was around 73%, 73%, something like that. I've seen net margins below 1%, perfectly healthy companies all over the place. So you have to look at them in relationship to the comps of the industry. And to a certain extent, you look at these again relative to each other. What kind of a decline, a path of decline do you see? Is it a shallow drop from gross to operating to net? Or is it a steep? Or is there, or are there two of them that are close together and one that's really down from the others? You just look at those. You get a feel for what they normally look like, what causes a bell to go off. I can't give you answers that are, well, you look at this. It's partly the sense of learning how to read them, getting a feel for what they normally look like, and listening to an incredibly good professor tell you about what to think or not. Okay, debt. Debt ratios are important, and I'm going to sneak a peek into the future with you a little bit with the debt ratios. Debt ratios. Oh, I'm sorry, I forgot one. Actually, there's two that I want to, in the profitability. Return on assets, ROA. Return on assets, ROA, is your sales over your total assets. Sales over total assets. Now, and there's another one too, ROE, return on equity, which is your sales over your equity, your total equity. Now, here's the thing. Let me look at ROA. Sales are over ROA. In a very real sense, the ROA is a yield. It's an interest. It is telling you how much as a percent you are earning off your assets. Look, suppose that I had an ROA of 18%. That would tell me that for every dollar of assets I have, they are making me 18 cents. That is the same as saying, in a way, if I were to invest my asset money in an account, could I make as much as I am the way I'm using that money? I've got $10 million in assets. Those are generating, oh, let's say, $600,000 in sales. That's telling me that my assets are creating 6% interest every year in terms of sales revenue. Again, we're talking about accounting numbers here, but this is very good to look at. It's your ROA. An ROA that is too low, well, obviously your assets aren't working. But an ROA that is very high can cause me concern too. I have several times when I heard cheerleading from younger financial analysts cheerleading, well, yeah, look at this ROA is unbelievable. Isn't that incredible? No, that's not necessarily incredible. Because that could mean that you are flogging those assets and sooner or later those assets are no longer going to be able to work for you. I could make you work 5 days, no sleep. I could just keep pouring drugs into you, coffee into you, using a cattle prod. And at the end of 5 days, what do I have? You all fall apart into tiny pieces, which all crawl off and live in a hippie commune for the rest of your natural life. Not good. I need you. I don't want to see you wearing tie-dye t-shirts.
You look ugly at. Really? You see, it's one thing to say, well, yeah, our assets are really working hard for us. Really? That's what happened in the oil refining business. We didn't put any new money into oil refineries for years and years and years. Guess what's been happening the last 5 years? They've been exploding, blowing up, burning to the ground, and wearing out. That's one of the principal reasons you saw spikes in the price of gasoline. Notwithstanding all the crap about, well, it's these speculators ruining the market. No, we have assets that worked and worked and worked and were never upgraded. So you had sales going up and up and up against asset bases that were staying the same. Well, yeah, ROA is going to go through the roof, as are most of the workers when the thing blows up. Harsh but fair. Do you understand the idea? It's not there's not a linear thinking process that we use here. We have to think both sides of the coin when we're looking at ROA. You date, right?
Sure.
Too skinny is bad, too big is bad.
Indeed.
But sometimes real skinny is great, real big is great. But it depends. What kind of a night is it? Right. We're together here, yeah. Real finance for real people. Follow with me here. See, what I'm trying to do is get you this nuance of your thinking on these subjects. And the same, here's we got return on equity. And this is saying, all right, our shareholders' money. This is shareholder money. This is what the shareholders, this is theirs. Okay? How well are we doing with that? What kind of sales are we generating with what the shareholders have graciously provided us? So, and again, there's a yield, a sense of a yield in there. What are we doing for our shareholders? And again, it's all over the board. And I'm going to have to be a little careful applying what I said about ROA to ROE. I've got to be a little careful there, but let me move on now. I'm going to take this off, and now I can get the debt ratios. Okay, debt. Debt to total assets. Not surprisingly, total debt over total assets. Total debt over total assets. Now here's the thing about total debt over the total assets ratio. This was actually almost in my time, a little before my time. This theoretical paper came out that seemed to indicate perfectly sound, very well done, that a corporation rationally should be 100% debt. You remember when I showed you the gains to leverage thing? How as your leverage goes up, your return on equity goes up. Well, if you just keep pushing that, the logical conclusion is we should see all corporations being 100% debt. So why don't we see that? Well, the reason we don't see that is because debt does not remain at the same cost as you use more and more of it, because your risk goes up. As you use more and more debt, if your income, if your revenue sales dip a little bit, you're dead. You're toast. So there is not, debt will go up in price as you gobble more and more and more of it, at least after a certain point. Ditto, equity actually has a cost. Your investors, your equity investors, expect a return on their money. So you have to deliver to them a return, which is reflected in your costs. And what we're talking about here is your cost of capital. Capital can be debt capital, it could be equity capital. And so what we're really looking for in one of the big things we talk about, and we'll do this in this class, is this thing called the optimal capital structure. Where is it that you have the best mix of debt and equity financing a company? See, if you have too much debt, your debt's going to cost you too much. If you have too much equity, you're giving up the cheap debt that you could get when you first start borrowing. So what you'll see is that this thing, this weighted average cost of capital, what we call the WACC, the weighted average cost of capital. As I go on, now debt to total assets, you see that would be between 0 and 1 always, because total assets are total equity plus debt. So this guy would be somewhere between 0 and 1. 100% debt. So if you had 0 debt, your assets would all be funded by equity, 0. If you had total debt, you would have no equity, so your assets would be all funded by debt instruments of one kind or another. So this would be between 0 and 1. So if I were to look at this total debt to total assets thing here and plot it between 1 and 0, we would see that the WACC, the weighted average cost of capital, actually is shaped sort of like a U, not necessarily a parabola. There are other kinds of U-shaped things like catenaries and all that kind of stuff. But one way or the other, it would have like this bottoming out feature. And companies bust their butts to know where this bottoming out place is. Where is the optimal mix of debt and equity? And to stay there, near that optimal mix. Now, it's not going to be the same for every company. You'll see different industries that'll seem to be aiming at different points. We assume the companies, at least in the large and over the long run, are rational. So we would figure that if we look at an industry over a long period of time, and we saw that most of the companies, let's say, seem to have debt to total asset ratios of about 35%, 0.35. Okay, that seems to be the low point of their weighted average cost of capital, is at about 35% debt, 65% equity. And then we'll see other industries where the leverage is much higher, 60, 70%. So it's dependent upon the industry. But here's the interesting thing that it's kind of, when I first heard about this, it sort of struck me as a little bit strange. You'll sometimes see companies that will have a bond issue, or they'll sell stock. And you say, okay, well, what are they financing with this? Oh, no, they're not financing anything. They're just moving their total debt to total assets ratio back to where their debt equity target is. That's what they're doing. They're not actually financing anything. They're just realigning so that they're getting back to where their weighted average cost of capital is at its bottom. It's kind of strange, issuing debt just so you can hit a target ratio that's in your plan, in your managerial thinking. Yeah, it'll happen, just to get back. And as a matter of fact, I've even seen now, since that time, I've seen their disclosure. This is being issued, bond is being issued because return our debt to equity, our equity ratio, to it's what we have determined to be at the optimal mix. So, I'll show you how to do weighted average cost of capital. Actually, it sounds like a fancy term, but it's actually really easy to calculate. It's just how much of one plus how much of one times its cost times plus how much of the other times its cost. Figuring out where it is, though, that's kind of an odd thing. My approach has always been, look at what the industry is doing. That probably tell you they're not crazy. They're probably aiming at some point. Each individual might be off, but as a group, they must know, that must be a herd understanding of where it would be. Now, another one that's just about the same as this one, debt to total assets, is debt to equity. As a matter of fact, that seems to be the one that has always been favored, is debt to equity ratio, which would, of course, which is total debt over total equity. Now, obviously, debt to equity could be anywhere between 0 and infinity. If you have no debt, then it would be a 0. If your firm were financed entirely by debt and there were 0 equity, then it would be infinity. These are really basically the same ratio, just expressed different ways. It seems like there's always been this kind of preference to say debt-equity ratio. You don't see the debt-total assets ratio. Maybe it's because it has one more syllable or two more syllables. I don't know. had a note here. I want to check something. Now, here's a very, very extremely cool one. Times interest earned. One of my favorites. I don't know why, but it's always been kind of a comforting one. Look at your EBIT. Earnings before interest and taxes divided by your interest, how much interest you pay, EBIT. What this one does is it tells you how many times over you can pay your interest on your that's currently come due. Just look at your financial statements. Take EBIT divided by the line right below it, and there's your times interest earned. It tells you how many times over you can pay the interest with the money right before you pay the interest. Now, ideally, here's a pretty easy rule. You'd want that to be like above one, because if it's below one, you can't pay your interest to your debt holders, and they're going to nail your butt. They're going to call for your heads. So you obviously would like to have that above one. But again, remember, we're talking that you're not really saying cash flow here, so you might have it below one. But once you add back in non-cash items like depreciation, it might be enough. But boy, the closer that thing gets to one, the more we sweat, really. So, does that mean that the bigger the better? Not necessarily. If I see a times interest earned that is very, very large, considerably larger than the industry, for example, I'd say you guys need to take on some more debt. You can finance projects. You've got more than enough money to pay interest. You got a lot of money to pay interest. Take on some more debt, because debt does achieve gains to leverage. You are turning away gains to leverage. You're nowhere near insolvency. You've got lots and lots. You can pay your interest 12 times over. Your times interest earned is 12 times. That's what that number will come out to be. It'll be like a factor. 12 times over, you can pay your interest. Really? You can pay a little more interest and borrow some money, pay a little more interest, and say, oh, realize a few gains to leverage from that extra debt. Now, there might be reasons why you wouldn't do that. Maybe debt is very expensive for this corporation and it can't do it. But at the same time, I really would be wondering why this corporation is throwing off so much cash compared to how much interest it owes in the current period. Now, there's a philosophy, of course, personally, the less debt, the better. Wonderful. I love it, and I encourage it. At the same time, in the business world, having no debt is not a good idea simply because you are rejecting gains to leverage. Does that mean that you should get debt out the butt? No. But keep an eye on that times interest earned. If it is very, very high, especially compared to the industry, also look at it over time. Look at it longitudinally. Has the times interest earned been going up or down? And ask yourself, why? What would be the reason? And you'd probably have to look at some other things to see. Maybe this company has decided that it doesn't need the aggravation of debt if its times interest earned has been going up. You don't know, but you can look and see what the dynamic is, if you can see some reason for the dynamic that you see longitudinally in that ratio. Trying to think if there's any other ones. Let me do the activity ratios here. Activity ratios. I'll come over here and do some for a little bit on this side of the board. The activity ratios, what the book calls the asset activity ratios. The asset activity ratios. And here's one, average collection period. Now, what I'll say here is, if you were looking at annual financial statements, you would use another number if you were using monthly financial statements. But what you look at is, you say, all right, the accounts receivable divided by the average credit sales. Now, average credit sales here would be your credit sales for the year
divided by 360.
Credit sales for the year divided by 360. Now, if this were monthly, you would have your credit sales for the month divided by 30. And you all are comfortable and know why we use 360, right? You have seen that. Some of you are nodding your head. If you haven't, please say so I can tell. Yeah. Okay, here's the way it was. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. The earth was without form. And darkness was upon the face of the deep. But there were five still bankers, and bankers have five holidays a year. What are the five holidays?
Christmas.
What else? Easter. What else? Not Labor Day, for God's sake. We're business people. For labor can work on that day. What else? Okay, we got Christmas, Easter, Thanksgiving. Huh?
Memorial Day.
Ma? 4th of July. And New Year's. Five bankers' holidays here. 360. Not Halloween, for God's sake. What do... I love Halloween. Scare the shit out of the kids. Anyway, sorry. Where the hell was I? Okay. It's actually... Yeah, go ahead.
How does Easter count as one of the five major holidays?
Well, I think it's like Good Friday. I'm pretty sure Easter is one of them. It's counted, but it's like the Good Friday. The banks are closed for it. And it's interesting. I've always assumed it was Easter. I don't think it's Memorial Day. I mean, I know. We're off. I mean, banks are off a couple of other days a year now, too. Veterans Day, yeah. The only day they care about us. But, so there are more now. But in the old days, and I come from this old school, we use 360. Now, a lot of books do 365 now. The weird-ass thing about it is the 360, there was actually a practical reason. I was kidding you about it going clear back to before Moses. There was actually a practical reason. In the early days of stock markets and stock exchanges, and I'm talking about in the 1700s and in the 1800s, we didn't have calculators. And slide rules really were not practical in a high-paced environment of a stock exchange. And yeah, they were still high-paced back then. The number 360, there is a set of rules for divisions by 360 so that traders and financial people could do the calculations very fast in their heads and with their hands with 360. 365 is a bear to work with, but 360, and I remember even when I was young, I could do it too, and I don't even remember all the rules now for it, but it was just that it calculated faster. That was the real reason we used 360 back in that time. Strangely enough, though, even in the days of 360, and I encourage use of the 360 just so that you can act like your old conservative, the old ways kind of people, there's a place where 365 is used even in the old formulas. Oddly enough, it's in the same formula where you use 360. I've never quite figured out how that worked, but yeah, the 360 was always done just because there was a calculation, a trick that could be done with it. Just like the rule of 72 and all those other quick, dirty rules, some numbers are very easy to work with compared to others. Like there's a rule for divisions by 3 and divisions, obviously by 2 and 5 as well. Okay, that's average collection period. What this does is essentially it says how long is it taking your sales to be paid, your credit sales to be paid off on average? How many days? How many days is it taking for you to get paid for a credit sale? Obviously, as that goes up, that's not so good because money has an opportunity cost. If someone owes you money, the longer they don't pay you, the more time you are without that money to do something with. Whether you do something with it or not, the question is, what's the opportunity cost of your money? Yes, it's great to get people to come into your store and buy stuff. And if you can get people to buy more by extending them credit, that's good. But if that is at the cost of you having the money from a sale for too long, well, that's a worry. And so we look at our average collection period to see how it's going up and down. If it's going down, well, maybe that's not so good. Maybe it is. It's not a judgment call. It's a call relative to the industry and also relative to the time. You've seen a lot of companies where they're trying to push down their average collection period because they don't want to be getting credit sales out because they're afraid people will default. At the same time, in boom times, average collection period will tend to increase because you're trying to grant sales to people, trying to get people in the door. You figure most of them will pay. So, and of course, the average payment period would be accounts payable over your average credit purchases divided by 360, the average credit purchases. Not sure if the book brings that one up so much, though. But here's one, inventory turnover. Inventory turnover is your sales divided by your inventory. How well are you turning over your inventory with sales? The higher this number is, the faster your inventory is turning over. It is a factor. It's a times kind of thing. When you do the division, you'll get a number, you hope above one, something like that. So if I got an inventory turnover of 4.2, that would say that every dollar of inventory is generating $4.20 of sales on me. So as that number goes up, your inventory is working harder for you. As that number goes down, your inventory is not working as hard. Now, it can go up because your sales are going up, but it can also go up because your inventories are going down. Now, here's where I'm going to take you into how you can use this stuff for macroeconomics as well. Look, just a couple of days ago, I was either yesterday or Friday, one of the numbers the government released was the inventory of manufacturing inventories. They fell notably in the latest reporting period. Inventories of manufacturers dropped. Now, if you get the answer wrong, that's fine. But tell me, is that bad news or good news? For everyone.
Good.
Why?
Because we're buying.
But there's a little more good news to it than that. Yes, we're buying. Well, that worries me a little bit. That worries me a little bit. Let's put that on the back burner. Here's the thing. Inventories are starting to slide. Look, the manufacturers are flat on their backs. Factories are not producing much. And now all of a sudden, quite noticeably, inventories have dropped. That means that people are buying. Businesses are buying from businesses. Consumers are buying. And the inventories that were in the warehouses suddenly just went like that. So what that means is that all of a sudden the manufacturers are going to say, inventories are going down. We're going to run out of stock of things if we don't start getting our assembly lines moving again. So what that tells me is that if these inventories went down, Clouville is going to call these manufacturers and say, hey, get your factory assembly lines moving again to replenish your inventories. If the factory assembly lines start moving again, that means that what will happen to the need for workers for those factory assembly lines? It should go up, right? And so that means that we'll begin to see the unemployment rate go down. But as the unemployment rate goes down, that means people are working. People working have money in their pocket. They go to the mall. They go to Walmart. They go to Aldi's in your case. They buy. But if they buy, that means that the inventories get sucked down again, which means that the manufacturers have to start hiring more workers to get more stuff to replenish the inventories. You see, it's like a building. On the way down, it's like a death spiral. But on the way up, it's a life spiral. So we're beginning to see what I'm pretty sure are the threads of an economic recovery that will be noticeable to the public in a few months. But right now, who would know? Who would think? Well, inventories went down. Big deal. Oh, but all that means is that means a whole lot of things, and it means good things, as long as the manufacturers get off their fat asses and start working again. Also, there's another cool thing from your sheet that your quiz. If the inventories are sliding, what is that? Is when inventories fall, is that a source or a use of cash? Inventories go down. Source or use? Source. That would mean that companies would be generating cash. At least they would be saving the use of cash. But if they're saving the use of cash, that means that they're going to have cash that they can use to hire and to turn on the factory belts again, the assembly lines again. Okay, now let me give you a couple more here. Total asset turnover. Total asset turnover is sales over total assets. Sales over total assets. Now, the last two that I'm going to give you here are the market ratios. The last two that I'm going to talk about here are the market ratios. And by the way, let me not slight that last one I gave you. Sales over total assets is telling me how much in sales are all of my assets producing for me. If sales are 10 million and my total assets are 5 million, what that says is that my total assets are creating, at least for the year, $2 in sales. Every dollar of my assets is creating $2 in sales. Higher would tell me that my assets are delivering more in sales per buck. Lower would tell me that my assets are delivering less. Again, though, the caution. Higher and higher and higher is not always better and better and better, because you could be back in that situation where if you don't replenish and build asset base, you could be burning up your assets. That rising ratio could be of concern. Yes, you want your assets to work hard, but you don't want them to work so hard that they explode. Now, the last two are the market ratios. One of them is very useful to us. The other one is the stupidest ass ratio in the world. And you hear it all the time on these financial help programs. The first one is useful, price to earnings, P/E. This is the market price of the stock divided by per share, the market price of the stock per share divided by the earnings per share, EPS. Earnings per share. This is telling you how much investors, how many dollars investors are willing to pay for $1 that the company has earned for them. You see, the earnings per share, you've already paid all the bills of the company. Your bills are all paid. So your earnings per share is shareholders' money. Now, you could be giving that out to them, but you're keeping that to plow back in. This EPS is saying, how much are investors thinking that dollar of theirs that you're going to use is going to produce for them in the future? That's what it tells us. Now, in my early days, I would have said earnings per shares, 5, 10, well, 15 is a little up there, a little scary. Paying $15 for $1 of current earnings, yeah, that's a little scary. Well, the 90s scared the crap out of us. You had EPS, you had P/E ratios up there, 100, 500. I think there was one Japanese stock that had 16,000, a P/E of 16,000. Are you nuts? They've come back into a little bit more reasonable line now. As a matter of fact, this weekend I was looking at Microsoft. Its P/E is 15.3. So that's just telling us that investors in Microsoft are saying they believe that they are going to get, as a present value, $15.30 for every dollar of their money that they're letting Microsoft have to earn money for them in the future. That's what it's saying. Now, the last one is, again, the stupidest ass. Market to book. That's the market price per share over the book value per share. In other words, equity, total equity, divided by shares outstanding. Market value per share. The reason this is such a stupid ass, book value has no meaning. book value of a stock, that's a historical value. It has all of these non-cash items in it. There is no account called book value. It's just an accounting number. So, but it's there it is, market to book. And that's all I have for you today. I thank you.